The Lord be with you. You're listening to a podcast from the teaching ministry of Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. For more multimedia content or to get more information, go to www.epiclesis.org. Now, here's Pastor Chris.
Today, let's talk about leprosy. Does that sound fun? I want to ask you a question. You can think about Bible days if you want to, or if you know something about leprosy, chime in. What does leprosy do? Say again. You don't feel pain, and why is that? Why do you not feel pain? It numbs the senses. It numbs the nerves. And as I understand it, especially what's called the peripheral nerves, it leaves your brain alone, your spinal cord alone, which again is a kind of horrible hell, isn't it? That the rest of the body is decaying and deteriorating. So if it numbs the peripheral nerves, that means you can get into some trouble pretty quick with hurting yourself and not feeling it, etc. Good. What else does leprosy do? As we talk about leprosy, what else does leprosy do? Yeah, I wrote that one down too. Did you hear what Darlene said? It isolates. In the case of biblical leprosy, you know that made someone unclean, and that means you can't go worship at the temple. And you have to go, and if you ever saw Ben-Hur, I guess, you have to go to some cave somewhere, and you have to be isolated. But I would think it happens wherever leprosy does happen, and I think it still does, even in our modern world, in some far-flung places. You have to go off to some colony somewhere, and so it isolates. What else does leprosy do? Think about it. It disfigures. Nurse Ruth says it disfigures. It does. You've seen probably some pictures on the interwebs of people who have leprosy and the horrible disfiguring it does. It takes up residence in your body and it incubates over time. That's something I learned about it. You can have it and not realize it. And some people went, over time, this thing incubates, and you cannot even be aware of it. It grows over time. So let's take stock in what we just said and keep that in the back of your noggin. It destroys nerves and senses. It disfigures. It isolates. It numbs the senses. It separates you from other people. Was there something I missed? It takes up a residence in your body and sort of incubates over time. As I was thinking about leprosy, Ellen sent a wonderful quote from Ephraim the Syrian. This is from Ephraim the Syrian, who, by the way, was a evidently wonderful hymnist. We were talking about writing hymns earlier, and supposedly he wrote thousands of them. Someone has said that there may even be up to 3 million lines of text from Ephraim the Syrian. And when you read him, the writing is beautifully poetic. Here's a quote about the very story that we're going to look at today. It's that story about Naaman and leprosy. So we're going to be headed to 2 Kings 5. But let me read you this quote from Ephraim the Syrian, because I want us to take some of those ideas and themes along in the story as well. Naaman was sent to the Jordan as to the remedy capable to heal a human being. Indeed, sin is the leprosy of the soul, which is not perceived by the senses, but intelligence has the proof of it. And human nature must be delivered from this disease by Christ's power, which is hidden in baptism. So what's he saying? There is a kind of leprosy that he calls sin, that infects your innards. It takes up residence in your soul. And he says you can't perceive it by your senses, but intelligence has the proof of it. You can recognize it, in other words. He writes this: it was necessary that Naaman, in order to be purified from two diseases, that of the soul and that of the body, might represent in his own person the purification of all the nations through the bath of regeneration, whose beginning was in the River Jordan, the mother and originator of baptism. I love that. So Naaman is a pagan from a foreign country, and here he comes to the nation of Israel, as it were, comes to God's people for healing. And Ephraim the Syrian is saying, hey, that's kind of what Christ does for us and for everybody, not just to the Jew, but for the Gentile. Having those things in mind, thinking about leprosy, and also this quote from Ephraim the Syrian, I want to read now the story, and we'll do some commenting along the way. 2 Kings 5, and I'm going to go all the way through verse 14 or so. Let me see. I might go a little farther. Yes, I am. We're going to go even to the end of the chapter, I think. Ready? It's a wonderful story. I think you probably know it, but let's listen with fresh ears. Now, Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. Isn't that an interesting little note? He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. By the way, this is the same fella who's about to lead the armies against the nation of Israel again. It happens again in the future after this episode. But the writer tells us, reminds us, this is because of what the Lord ordained, allowed. Verse number 2. Now, bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. So get this, there's a young Israeli girl who's in the household of Naaman, and she's a servant of some kind. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means, go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." Isn't that, I love that little thing. That little detail. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. He didn't pack light. That's a lot of stuff. I want you to imagine that in your spiritual imagination. Can you see Naaman getting ready to go, and all of his stuff is there by the front door? He's waiting on his Uber, whatever. And he has all of this stuff, right? It's all packed and ready to go. And it's a lot. Now, change of scene over to the throne room of the king of Israel. Ready? As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy?" See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me. Isn't that interesting? Here's the king of Israel who ought to know about God and God's saving acts and deeds, and he immediately assumes that there's geopolitical scheming taking place. He doesn't take the letter for its face value, but rather assumes that the king of Aram is using this as a pretext so they can start another war. We can't blame him too much because apparently there were lots of wars back and forth. Verse 8, "But when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message." So here comes another letter. "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Stop there for a second, and in your spiritual imagination, kind of sort of feel what that might look like. "Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, 'Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be cleaned.' But Naaman went away angry and said, 'I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot,'" don't you just love this? "'Wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not the Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?' So he turned and went off in a rage." What a story. I love that. I found one commentator who writes this. "I like to picture Elisha living in the ancient Near Eastern equivalent of a rundown mobile home somewhere out in an overgrown field. Today, you would not expect the presidential motorcade to come roaring up to such a trailer in the middle of nowhere with police motorcycles, flashers, flashing sirens, etc. But Elisha lives in a hovel, in front of which suddenly roars up Naaman's whole entourage of horses and chariots and whatnot. Anybody that says whatnot, I'm a fan of their writing. Probably he had some trumpeter herald his arrival, even as servants unrolled a strip of red carpet for Naaman to walk on after regally disembarking from his chariot. Can you see it in your spiritual imagination? But then, just to keep this interplay between the lofty and the lowly going a bit more, we're told that Elisha just sends his messenger to tell Naaman what to do. The trumpet blares to announce the great man's arrival. He walks to Elisha's front door on the red carpet, but then the door to the trailer opens a crack, and some low-life servant peers out over the top of the door's security chain to tell Naaman to go to the river to wash 7 times. And no sooner does the little servant say this, he quickly recloses the door. I love that. So get the scene. He's shown up in a lot of fanfare and puffery. And he doesn't get the answer he thought he was going to get. I think Ephraim the Syrian is right. There's another disease at work here as well in the soul. More on that later. Picking up at verse number 13. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you have not done it? How much more then when he tells you, wash and be cleansed?" Very next verse. "So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy." Those of you, by the way, who have been to the Jordan know that at least parts of it are really grimy and gross. And apparently, depending upon the season, it's kind of always been that way. So here's this guy who has, a lot of pride. And he submits to this word from the man of God he hasn't even seen yet and goes and dips in what, at least when I was there, looked like a fetid swamp. It's a good ACT word for you there, students. Fetid. Verse number 15. "Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, 'Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant.' The prophet answered, 'As surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing.' And even though Naaman urged him, he refused." Wow, pretty impressive. Before we go on to the next part, I need to tell you a little bit about Aramean and Syrian gods. Does that sound interesting? Gosh, we've covered leprosy and now Assyrian and Aramean gods. There was a god that the Arameans called Rimmon or Rimmon. We're going to see that in just a second. But in Syria, that god is called by a name that you probably know, Baal. And among other things, this god's symbol is a thunderbolt because Rimmon is a god of thunder and noise. By the way, and this will be important in a minute, Baal means Lord, or it can mean owner, O-W-N-E-R. Keep that in the back of your mind. It can mean owner. That's going to become important in just a minute. The reason I tell you about this Rimmon god or Rimmon or Rimmon is because at verse 17, as we continue, you're going to see what happens here. "If you will not take these things," said Naaman, continuing verse 17, "please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord." What's he going to do? He's taken some of the very ground from that place and taking it back to this foreign pagan place, and he's going to make sacrifices to the living God. Wow, what a transformation. That's amazing. Look at verse 18. "But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he's leaning on my arm, and I have to bow down there also, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this." What's he saying? hey, when I go back home, there's a bit of a cultural thing that I have to do because I'm not doing it of my own volition. I am the servant of a master greater than I. And we go to this temple and he's going to kneel down. And because I have to steady him, I got to kneel down too. But I'm not kneeling down in my heart. May the Lord forgive me for this thing I must do. And Elisha says, go in peace. Now, I want to introduce you to another servant. We've mentioned a couple already. There was the servant girl who was from Israel who went to the house of Naaman. You remember her? And then there's a servant who opens the door to the trailer, who opens the door to Naaman. It may be a different servant than the one we're talking about. Not sure. But we get to learn the name of at least the main sidekick servant of Elisha. And his name is Gehazi. Let's see what happens to him. Verse 19, go in peace, Elisha said. After Naaman had traveled some distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, my master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean. Isn't that interesting? He's kind of parsing it all out himself. He's gone too easy on him by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, that's oath-taking, by the way, I will run after him and get something from him. Gehazi sees an opportunity to grease his own palm a little bit. So he's going to run after Naaman, and it won't be hard to find because he's traveling with all that luggage, right? And all the chariots and the puffery. So Gehazi hurried after Naaman, and when Naaman saw him running toward him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. Isn't that also remarkable? Is everything all right? He asked. Verse 22, everything's all right, Gehazi answered. My master sent me to say, by the way, did the master send him? Nope. My master sent me to say, two young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and two sets of clothing. Stop right there just a second. Not only is Gehazi greedy, and not only is he lying about that, and he's done an oath, gosh, to involve God in that way, in this plot, but he's gone after him, and he's lied really big. I mean, there are a lot of details in this lie. It's a story. He made it all up. Verse 23, by all means, take two talents, said Naaman. He urged Gehazi to accept them and then tied up the two talents of silver in two bags with two sets of clothing. He gave them to two of his servants and they carried them ahead of Gehazi. When Gehazi came to the hill, he took the things from the servants and put them away in the house. He sent the men away and they left. They go over the brim of the hill. He takes those things. My mind goes back to the sin in the desert at the mountain. Achan, the fellow who kept the stuff in his tent. Gehazi keeps it for himself. When he went in and stood before his master, Elisha asked him, where have you been, Gehazi? By the way, that reminds me of the place in the garden when God said to Adam, where are you? What you doing? Elisha says, where have you been, Gehazi? Your servant didn't go anywhere, Gehazi answered. What a moron. What a goober smack. That's a good southern word for you, by the way. How dumb. The whole thing is dumb. Making an oath to go do this thing is dumb. Stealing is terribly sinful, but also dumb. Bringing all this stuff back to the trailer park is dumb. And now to lie to the man of God whom you've seen do amazing things. That's just dumb. But Elisha said to him, verse 26, was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Wow. What's he saying? I was there too. I saw it. Elisha knows. Is this the time to take money or to accept clothes or olive groves and vineyards or flocks and herds or male and female slaves? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and your descendants forever. Then, watch this. Gehazi went from Elisha's presence, and his skin was leprous. It had become as white as snow. One of the side benefits, air quotes, of leprosy is that large patches turn just white. The skin is dead. Isn't that interesting? Now, let's compare and contrast just a little bit this commander named Naaman and Gehazi. I wrote down some things that occurred to me. Maybe you have some as well. Both of them had front seats to power, though of a different kind. There's Naaman, who's a commander, who's right there in the thick of things, and he's surrounded by opulence. He's right hand to the king. He even helps the king bow down when the king is worshiping Baal. Baal, the Lord, quote. Baal, the owner, quote. And there is our friend Gehazi. He's at the front seat of power. He's seen all kinds of amazing things, this man of God. Both of these fellows, in some ways, were great. They were next to greatness, for sure. Both of them saw God's wondrous acts and deeds firsthand. Naaman sure did. He was cleansed. How many times had Gehazi seen God move and act in his life and in others? Here's another thing that they both had in common. They both were prideful. One was cured of his pride and his leprosy. Remember Ephraim the Syrian saying that he's cured of two things that day? The pride fell off, which may have been incubating in him for a long time. The pride falls off before the leprosy does. The pride falls off, and he agrees to go and dip in this river, which he has better ones back home. Then he's cured of the leprosy. The other one, Gehazi, his pride is growing inside. There's a kind of leprosy in Gehazi. And this pride finally shows itself. And then comes the leprosy. Let's talk about pride just a minute. Pride is disobedience to God's most important command to love him above all else and our neighbors as ourselves. So, in this story, what exposes the pride? Remember the quote from Ephraim? He says, "Leprosy of the soul is not perceived by the senses, but intelligence has the proof of it." How did Elisha expose Naaman's pride? Well, he sent the servant to answer the door. That got his hackles up. And then this business about, you want me to go dip in that nasty thing over there? And then the servants say, hey, if he'd asked you to do some really spectacular thing, you would have done that. Pride, prideful. How does Elisha expose the servant's pride? Think about that one just a second. How does he expose it? Well, he certainly sees him make the choice to go after the chariots. I'd like to think he also gives him the opportunity to come clean. But the pride has taken hold. It's incubating. So at the beginning, I ask you, what is it that leprosy does? And now I want to ask you, what is it that pride does? What is it that pride says? I think pride, like Ephraim the Syrian, is a thing in us that's like a leprosy. And I went back and I looked at those, what would you call them, symptoms of leprosy and compared it to pride. Pride takes up residence in your body and it incubates over time. Right? Yeah? It's slow growing, can be anyway. Pride disfigures from the inside out. It turns you into something different. You look different. If you're prideful, it numbs the senses Doesn't pride numb the senses? We become less and less sensitive to the reality around us. We become less and less sensitive to people around us. We become less and less sensitive to the pain that others might bear because we're prideful. And pride separates you from others. I don't want to be around those people. Why, I'm better than they are. I never would say that out loud. Pride says, I'm better, or more sophisticated, or I understand more than all of these folks over here. Pride says, I deserve more. Heather said to me one time, one of the problems with, we were talking about overeating, and I was getting counseling from her about dieting, and she said, one of the problems with gluttony is it says, I want more than my fair share. Pride does too. Pride says, I want more. I want more than my fair share. Pride says, I will not be accountable to anybody but me. Think about that one in the Christian context. That's not how we're supposed to live our lives as believers. Pride says, I'll apportion my time and my talents and my treasure the way I want to. That's pride. I'll give here, but not over here. I will do my time here. I'll go over here and do something great, but I'm not going to go dip in the water over there. I'll apportion my money and my time and my abilities in the way I want to. Pride says, my sins are not that big a deal. Pride says, I've kind of got this whole Christian spirituality thing figured out. That's pride. Pride says that you're going to get what you can. There's Gehazi. And in his growing pride, he says, I'm tired of seeing this stuff. I'm going to go get mine. I deserve it. It's not going to hurt anybody. I'm going to stand up for what's mine. And that can happen with physical things and not physical things. I'm going to speak my own truth. Have you heard that one? I'm going to take ownership. I'm going to own that. Remember that one of the titles of Baal is the owner? So I want to ask you today if you have leprosy. Oh, not the skin kind, but the kind that Ephraim writes about. It eats you away from the inside. It numbs the senses. It makes you want to own stuff. It says that I'll do what I want to do. Let me close with this wonderful quote that I think hits it right on the head. And it's from the beloved C.S. Lewis. And it comes from his book, The Screwtape Letters. Remember that the Screwtape Letters is a kind of a dialogue between a lesser demon and his demonic overlord. And so when they're talking about the enemy, they're talking about God. And when they're talking about their Lord, they're talking about Satan. And this greater demon is giving the under demon some advice on how to tempt and how to cause the humankind to sin. And he makes observations about human nature, etc. So here is a little piece of conversation from the greater demon to the lesser underling student demon. The sense of ownership in humans in general is always to be encouraged. The humans are always putting up claims to ownership which sound equally funny in heaven and in hell, and we must keep them doing so. Much of the modern resistance to chastity comes from people's belief that they own their own bodies. We produce this sense of ownership not only by pride, but also by confusion. We teach them not to notice the different senses of the possessive pronoun, the finely graded differences that run from my boots through my dog, my servant, my wife, my father, my master, my country, to my God. They can be taught to reduce all these senses to that of my boots, the my of ownership. We have taught men to say, my God, in a sense, not really very different from my boots, meaning the God on whom I have a claim for my distinguished services. And all the time, the joke is that the word mine, in its fully possessive sense, cannot be uttered by a human being about anything. In the long run, either our father, Satan, or the enemy, God, will say mine of each thing that exists, and specially of each human. But the humans will find out in the end, never fear, to whom their time, their souls, and their bodies really belong. Certainly not to them, whatever happens. Let's pray. Father, some of us come here today, maybe all of us, with the sin of pride, and it's like leprosy. It incubates over time, it disfigures, it numbs the senses. And all along, Lord, this leprosy of sin, this pride, causes us to think of things as ours, our time, our money, our resources. I pray that today we would find cleansing from this leprosy of pride, that it would no longer disfigure us, that it would no longer numb our senses, that it would no longer separate us from others. And I pray that you would take up residence in our hearts and wash us and cleanse us. Help us to be willing to do the lowly thing. And we thank you for your cleansing. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.
You've been listening to a podcast from Epiclesis, an ancient future faith community. If you'd like to learn more about ancient future faith or worship with us at Epiclesis, visit us on the web at www.epiclesis.org. The Lord be with you.